This year marks Lauren Mazel's seventh and final season as music director of the New York Philharmonic. Over his career, he has conducted over 150 orchestras and at least 5,000 opera and concert performances. And among his many achievements so far this year alone, he's been named a Commandeur of the French Legion of Honor and an honorary Kentucky Colonel. Last year, he and the New York Philharmonic played a historic concert in Pyongyang, North Korea. Next month, he's kicking off the three-week Castleton Festival in Virginia. I'm pleased that all of those things bring Maestro Lauren Mazel to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
Did you know at a very young age that you wanted to be a conductor? Because most conductors kind of, as I understand it, slip into it. They're performers, and somewhere along the line they realize that they're attracted to this other aspect of creating music.
Well, it's quite true. I got started quite early. But
9 years old.
Through no fault of my own. My teacher felt that I had a certain conducting talent as... apart from the musical talent, having a musical talent does not suffice. You need the manuality and the ability to communicate to others through motion how you feel about a phrase, and to keep folks together. Something called ensemble. As an adult, I discovered that I had this repertoire and all this experience, but I wasn't quite sure I wanted to be a conductor, and I was thinking of becoming a writer. But the call of the wild, that is the wild music, because it is a wild experience for those who love it, was too strong for me, so I came back to it, and I haven't regretted it for a moment.
Well, you conducted the New York Philharmonic for the first time when you were just 12 years old. Was that kind of a gimmicky thing, or was that a legitimate thing?
Well, as I said before, my teacher felt that I had a conducting talent, plus the ear and the memory and all the other things that you need. And I don't believe the New York Philharmonic would have tolerated a gimmick, nor the NBC, nor any of the other major orchestras that I conducted as a young person. No, I was a real thing. I just got started rather early.
Most conductors are former pianists. Some of them are string players. I've never seen a French horn player become a conductor. Is there a reason?
Well, in fact, there is one right now in Italy, a rather good French horn player. It remains to be seen how good a conductor he is. But it is it does a disservice to our profession if players, instrumentalists, who have achieved fame, and rightfully so, for having mastered their instruments, then add their incompetence to the gigantic amount of incompetence they themselves have encountered on the podium.
Is the Peter Principle, you are a great performer, so then you become a second-rate conductor?
Yeah, that's a very bad idea, very bad. There were some people like Leonard Bernstein, who had marvelous gifts in all three areas. He was a fine composer, a fine conductor, and a fine pianist. So was Rachmaninoff. So was Gustav Mahler. But these are exceptions.
And you've just recently started performing some of your own compositions. Since this is something you've only added into the repertoire late, it's not the same thing as Bernstein or Rachmaninoff or Mahler.
I have recently performed my own music with the New York Philharmonic, but I've been writing music all my life. And it was, in fact, about 20 years ago, thanks to Mr. Osipovich, that I decided to write works of a larger nature, and have written, well, quite a few when I had the time to do so.
Can you spot the kind of talent that would lead to being a good conductor?
Well, I did have a conductor's competition, and two people I did spot as being as having a great deal of potential. One was Xian Chang, a Chinese woman who has been making a fine career, and the other, of course, is Gustavo Dumedel, who is, as you know, the music director of the Los Angeles Philharmonic. You can't really define what it is that makes a fine conductor, but you can recognize it right away.
Because there's some, well, I'd imagine one of the things is the ability to get people to do what you want them to do. We see the same sort of thing in sports. For example, a quarterback can have a great arm, a lot of ability, but if he can't convince the other members of the team to follow what he wants, it's not going to work out. I mean, when you show up at an orchestra for the first time, you have to do something, I imagine. Well, your reputation precedes you, but when you were starting, you had to do something to convince them that they actually wanted to trust you.
Well, it's more than something. A conductor must command the respect of the musicians whom he's conducting. They have to feel that he has a right to be there. That he does very, very quickly by simply showing that he knows the score, that he knows how to use the baton effectively for all the things it's supposed to be used for.
I've heard a funny story from years ago where somebody picked up a telescope in the middle of a rehearsal. I think it was with Bruno Walter. And Walter said, "What's that all about?" And he said, "Just searching for the downbeat, maestro."
Oh.
Yeah, which, of course, did not endear him to the conductor. But I'm sure there are any number of musicians who feel they know perfectly well how things should be and might not always go along with the conductor.
Well, that's quite true. But they respond very well to conductors whom they respect. But the principle I've always followed is that I respect the people who are sitting in front of me, each one of whom is an expert, a virtuoso, a great musician, and with enormous experience. And so if I interact with them, I have to feel secure in what I have to offer, and I feel that's the least I can do to justify my presence on that podium, to justify the whole exercise of those who follow and those who lead.
My guest is Lauren Mazel. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Are there as many young, talented artists who want to go on to careers in serious music as there used to be?
There are ever more. In fact, there are more and more young people coming into classical music than there are flocking to listen to it in our part of the world. It's kind of drying up to a certain extent in the United States. That is not the case in Spain or France. That is certainly not the case in Japan. And, of course, China has opened the youth barrier, if you will, to classical music. They've embraced it totally.
Well, I can understand Japan and China because they had another musical tradition, and this is new to them, something they can become enthusiastic about on top of their own. But why Spain and France and not the United States?
Well, I think it's because of a mindset. In some European countries, not all, art is considered to be as important as food, shelter, and all the rest. It's nurtured, and in fact, in many of these cultures, considered to be the driving force in the arena of human activity. I happen to think it is too. The arts, all the performing arts, and of course the figurative arts. That's where man finds his soul, and young people are getting awfully tired of the arid expression of rock and music that doesn't have the dimension that they need in order to grow, in order to develop. And so they turn to what it is that we do.
Well, you are rather familiar with Spain because you're also music director of the Palau de las Artes, Reina Sofía, forgive my pronunciation, Valencia. That's a new organization, isn't it?
Yes, it was a fantastic opera house built by Calatrava, the world-famous architect who happens to be from Valencia.
And who's been a guest on the show a couple of times.
It was 13 years in the building and cost over $1.5 billion.
Wow.
But it was worth it. Acoustics are fantastic.
Because that's something I've always been curious about. The acoustics of some of the really old concert halls and opera houses were always great. And then we went through a period where They weren't as good, and you would have thought that we would have figured it out along the way. You've had to contend with Avery Fisher Hall.
Not all the old halls were great by any means. A few of them, yes. The Concertgebouw in Amsterdam, the Musikverein in Vienna. But there's some new halls which are absolutely incredible. One is in Spain, Zaragoza. One is in Japan, Sapporo. And the opera house we have in Valencia fortunately has marvelous acoustics. And we have a young orchestra. I had the honor and privilege of selecting every member of that orchestra. And they've made waves in the best sense of the word.
And you're leaving the Philharmonic, but you're not leaving the situation at the Reina Sofia, are you?
Well, no, I decided to stay on a couple of years. I feel sort of patriarchal, if you will, fatherly after, you know, these young people look to me for guidance, not only in the pit, but also emotionally and with regard to their careers. So that I'm very, very keen to go on being of help there as long as I can.
Because this is also a teaching thing?
Well, no, I don't teach there, no. I will be giving master classes in the festival in Castleton, Virginia, our first edition starting July 3. Master classes supported by the Rolex Corporation. They rather thought that this would be a good idea to finally document what it is that an eldest statesman in the world of conducting thinks about conducting and in a way that is beneficial and constructive.
July 3rd is just a short time off. Do you take any breaks between leaving one job and going on to the other one?
I'm taking 4 months off right now after the Castleton Festival. I need time to compose, to regroup, and to play tennis.
Uh-huh. Well, I was wondering about the opera that you wrote based on Orwell's 1984. Will you be performing that anywhere, in Valencia or elsewhere?
Well, in fact, it was to have been performed in Valencia, and we had a flood. And the theater was set back a couple of months, and one of the productions we were not able to make happen was 1984. But it will be performed there in February 2011.
What's it like to conduct your own piece? There are people who, playwrights, for example, who believe that it's a good idea to direct your play because you really understand it. Others say you should keep the writer as far away from the material as possible, because part of the whole process is that collaborative thing.
Oh, well, the music that I write is very personal, and I'm embarrassed to have people hear just how I feel about things of great importance to me. So I hesitate to conduct my own music, and in fact, during the 7 years I was with the New York Philharmonic, with the exception of one birthday concert, devoted entirely to my own music. The first and last work is the one I conducted last week, Farewells. But I've gotten to the point now where I can interpret my own music as if it had been written by someone else.
Well, we don't know what Mahler sounded like when he was conducting his own music, but we have recordings of Rachmaninoff, we have Stravinsky, don't we, and Boulez and others. As a conductor with a sophisticated ear, do you learn things from the way they approach the music that might be different from the way you might have?
Well, composers are generally rather shy about performing their own music. Rachmaninoff certainly was, and he tended to play everything that he wrote a little bit faster than he would have wanted it, really. I actually knew Rachmaninoff, spoke to him, and he told me that he hated to play his own music. And he just wanted to get it over with, which is, I understand, a kind of embarrassment. You don't feel at ease in the material you yourself have written. Mahler also, there's a recording of his playing his Fourth Symphony at tempi that absolutely inconceivable. He couldn't possibly have meant that. He was just in a hurry, wanted to get it over with, walked into a sound studio. At that time, you could only record 5 minutes at a time, and just went for it and walked out the studio. That's the way people, great composers, tend to treat their own music with a certain disrespect.
Well, Mahler, I can't imagine. How many discs would a Mahler symphony take? 12-inch discs, need a big album. A listener points out that Gunther Schuller was a French horn player who became a conductor. You know, so much for me being a wise guy and coming up with I should have said oboe player or flutist or something like that.
Oboe player.
There's got to be one now, right?
There must be one out there.
My guest is Lorne Mazel, who is leaving the New York Philharmonic, but has lots of other projects in the works. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. Don't forget to check out our video section on our show page. You can take a peek inside our studios with guests like Peter Hoffman, Isaac Mizrahi, and Sam Mendes. And we just filmed the one I've done with Lorne Mazel, which should be posted sometime soon. You click on Video Picks. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're listening to a composition by Lorne Mazel, played by the great flutist James Galway. I think you heard the first note and you knew immediately that it was yours.
Well, I should hope so. Good grief.
And we went out with something by Beethoven. Do you have certain favorites, or are they all interesting to you?
Of Beethoven?
I mean, composers in general.
Oh.
Every interpreter
worth his salt always answers that question the same way. You love most what you're doing at that moment because that's your job. You have to identify with the material, make it come alive, feel good about it, and put all other music out of your mind, especially if you're working in an idiom which is rather shallow. For example, Johann Strauss' Waltz. You can't compare that with the Bruckner Symphony, right? But you want to make that happen, and you love those waltzes for what they are. Don't demand anything from them that they can't give you or the listener. So
so it's a matter of showing off the piece to its best.
Showing off is not a word in my vocabulary. Okay. But you do try to put their best foot forward with a bit of help from you to make the music alive and meaningful to the folks who, after all, have gathered together to have an artistic experience worth remembering.
A listener left a question on our show page. She writes, what does it feel like to be playing in a hall with bad acoustics versus a good hall? And do you have to make adjustments, and how does it manifest itself?
Well, if I'm ever remembered for anything, for having said anything, it's that there are no bad acoustics, there are only bad conductors. And indeed, almost every hall, if it's got a roof and walls, has an acoustic, and it's up to the interpreter to deal with it as best he or she can. I believe that I've made a certain contribution to the acoustics of Avery Fisher Hall, and I haven't read for years that the hall has bad acoustics. It doesn't. They just hadn't been handled well. It required a lot of moving about and shifting of instruments and erecting of panels and so forth. But I think we got it right, finally.
The Philharmonic now releases its own records. For a long time, it was on RCA, if I remember correctly. Or was it Columbia? That is a reflection of declining record sales. Is that a problem? Declining record sales and the growing age of audiences?
Well, the CD has been replaced by the download, and that's fine with me. Important thing is that the folks out there continue to hear the music they love, and interpreted by interpreters in whom they have confidence. Whether it's a download or an old CD is really irrelevant. And of course, you have now have the DVD, and there'll be new, you know, your credit card can contain about 50,000 hours of music. That's coming too. You just insert it in some kind of panel or slot, and you'll have Dolby wraparound.
But when I was a kid, there were live concerts on the radio. We don't have much of that anymore. The whole classical music world seems to have shrunk, at least. I mean, there are still concerts, but I think that the audience is a more limited, committed audience, isn't it?
I don't think so. No, it's just going through the same kind of metamorphosis as all of society. Everything we do is being done differently, from Facebook to Twitter.
You know, so it's just a matter of figuring out how to connect?
Exactly. And to use the means of communication available to us in today's world in a way that allows us to keep in contact with our audience.
Last year, the New York Philharmonic went to Asia, and the orchestra performed in North Korea. Were people in North Korea familiar with the music?
Well, what none of us knew is that for the last 40 years, Russian and East German mentors, teachers, professors had been training North Korean musicians in classical music, and that North Korean ensembles had played in Russia and in East Germany before it became a part of the Germany we know today. So there is a tradition there, and all of us, speaking of my colleagues of the New York Philharmonic, and I were stupefied to see the high level of music making in the conservatories and by the orchestras that are playing there. In fact, I conducted one just for fun. Two-and-a-half-hour rehearsal, and I was blown away by the very high technical and musical standard of the orchestra.
Many people saw this as an indication that things were getting a little friendlier between the United States and North Korea. And so are you surprised by the recent belligerent turn of events?
Well, I think in the arena of human affairs, you have this two-step forward, one step backward. In this case, it was one step forward and three steps backward. But the impression that we left there, I know, is long-lasting. And I know people won't forget what happened and the meaningful quality of an enemy on stage with whom you are officially at war playing its national anthem and everybody standing up and cheering. We played the Star Spangled Banner in Pyongyang, period. And that will never be forgotten by anyone. And we also played Arirang, a folk tune that they all love. So, yes, there are factions in the government which are bellicose. That's true of every government.
And you didn't have to clear things with Kim Jong-il's government, what you played and what you didn't?
No. We were invited by the North Korean government to give a concert, which we did. We insisted that it be available to everyone and that we play the music we wanted.
Now, you must have been prepared for some of the negative criticism, like Terry Teachout's in the Wall Street Journal, where he said the concert was a puppet show that gave legitimacy to a despicable regime.
Well, in the Wall Street Journal, on the op-ed page, was my rebuttal. And it seemed to have been very, very effective because we've had none of that criticism since, because the folks who write it know, with all due respect, considerably less about such regimes than yours truly. While they were still in diapers, I was conducting in communist countries all over Europe, from Russia, Poland, Bulgaria, Romania, Czechoslovakia, you name it, I was there. I saw it. Things a lot worse than can be seen in North Korea. So the reason I went there at that time is the same reason I went to Pyongyang, because people want to know that you care, that you are aware of them, and that your presence there represents another way of looking at the relations between the country you represent and their own.
I remember Saul Urok was also criticized many years ago for doing the same sort of thing during the Cold War and bringing Soviet orchestras here and Soviet ballet here and bring American orchestras to the Soviet Union. Then after you conducted in Pyongyang, you went to South Korea. What was their response to your having been in the North?
Well, I became some kind of national hero for no reason at all. I mean, I'm just a conductor, and I conducted a concert. But they saw it very symbolically. I mean, I was greeted by the prime minister and the president of the country, and they said, you have no idea what you've done for us, because you've shown that a door can be opened, that people can walk through it. Even if it takes another half century, you have taken a very big step, and we shall never forget it, and we'll always be grateful to you for having taken it, even though it wasn't my idea at all. And I was, I had something called the New York Philharmonic in front of me. They, too, made that contribution. I just happened to be their representative and their symbol.
My guest is Lorne Mazel, who is ending his seventh and final season as music director of the New York Philharmonic, but he has all sorts of other interesting projects in the works, and we will get to those in just a moment. But I wonder, when you arrived at the New York Philharmonic, did you have any specific goals that you hoped to accomplish?
Yes, I wanted to stay 7 years.
And 7 years was your goal?
Yes, and it's just the number that I've stayed for. And so I programmed a 7-year concept, which would include several cycles, including the Mahler cycle, which we're now ending with the performance of the 8th this week. It gave me a point of reference. I was very happy to do so in that way, because I was able to program first performances, reviews of Baroque music, perform works that have rarely or never been performed at the New York Philharmonic. At the same time, constructing programs that had vertical integrity, because of the trouble with concepts is that it works horizontally, but that one evening you couldn't care less about the programming, and that's unfortunate. So I've always tried throughout these 7 years to conceive of a program that would have vertical and horizontal significance.
Well, New York Philharmonic is particularly prominent, and I'm sure there's a certain amount of pressure, and I'm sure you got a lot of advice as well for people. Don't play certain kinds of music. Play others. Whatever you did, I understand there's been an increase in attendance since you've been musical director, so you must have figured out something.
I must have got something right. Who knows what it is?
Tell me a bit about Castleton.
Castleton, Virginia?
Yeah. You live down there?
Yeah. We have a farm down there, and we had a hen house that used to house 15,000 hens. Who dutifully laid 15,000 eggs every day, which were shipped into Washington for sale. And when we bought the farm, the hen house had long since been shut down, but the building was there, an enormous structure. Long story short, we constructed a theater there. We launched it about 12 years ago with Rostropovich. In fact, Bronfman was there as well. And the second part of the program, we played the Tchaikovsky piano trio, Rostropovich on the cello, Bronfman piano, and I was playing the violin. And we've had about 100 performances since then of Indian dance groups, of prestidigitators, jazz, lots of jazz concerts. We've had recitals. We've had the readings of the women of Shakespeare. We've had a very broad spectrum of programs. But when I first came on the idea of giving a chamber opera there, I chose The Turn of the Screw about 3 years ago. Henry James' story set to music by Benjamin Britten. Success was really quite amazing. And what I loved is that the young people whom I had the pit felt that it was a life-changing experience. And I watched over the next three years a festival in the making. It really defined itself. And finally, we decided to formalize it and call it the Castleton Festival. And we're presenting four revivals of the four Benjamin Britten operas we already have in our repertoire, plus two concerts with the participation of musicians from Qatar, from the Royal College of Music in London, from Charlottesville, and from Juilliard and Curtis. This festival is participant-friendly. It's about the people who go there, the young people who crave mentoring from musicians who have made their way and have achieved status. I'm very grateful to three colleagues of mine from the New York Philharmonic who will be down there also mentoring. We have a whole team of stage designers and stage directors who are also young and making their first statements.
And you have a residency program for young musicians. How is this different from your traditional conservatory?
Well, firstly, there's the interaction between all the disciplines. You'll have the bassoon having lunch with the first bassoon, with the second soprano, sitting next to the stage designer and the assistant, you know, the stage director assistant, and a conducting student, and everybody sitting around the same table for 3 weeks, immersed in the material, exchanging ideas, finding out what it is that the others do, so that when it all comes together, you have a feeling of united effort. It's a 2.5-week festival. We're giving 12 performances of opera and two concerts, and we've erected a tent as an auxiliary venue for performance.
Is this a one-shot thing, or is this going to be an annual festival?
It's certainly an annual festival. Yeah, this is our first edition, and we're already planning next year's events.
You've said that being physically fit is important for conducting. So do you have to really work out?
Well, I conduct. That's about all the aerobics I need. I apparently have good genes, so I'm still hanging in there and doing my thing. I may be the only 79-year-old person who has all his teeth. How about that? Guinness Book of Records, okay? All 32, and which is a sign, I suppose, of fairly solid, good health. And, I mean, that's a totally irrelevant point. The reason I make it is that it all goes together. And enthusiasm and commitment to what you're doing, I think, is life-prolonging.
And I have a feeling that you're not thinking of retiring anytime soon.
Yeah, I was thinking of taking early retirement at the age of 95, but I've recently changed my mind.
We have a link to the Castleton Festival on our show page at WNYC.org. Our listeners want to know more and know about how they might be able to participate or at least go to some of the performances. My great thanks to Lauren Mazel, who is stepping down after 7 years as conductor of the New York Philharmonic. But as I said earlier, he's conducted over 150 orchestras all over the world. So there are lots of other places that you can still go, right?
Well, I hope so. It depends on the folks out there. They still want me.
I think they'll want you. Thank you again so much.
Thank you.
On tomorrow's show, Buzz Aldrin looks back at landing on the moon 40 years ago and how that changed his life. And then Dean Olscher on the history and psychology of crossword puzzles and the directors of the film Mrs. Gundo's Daughter, about a Malian mother's fight to protect her daughter from genital mutilation by seeking asylum in the United States. Plus, a look at some independent farmers who are fighting against agribusiness. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Miranda Schaefer, Nicole Silbersack, and Natalie Pano. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We will see you tomorrow.